Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm Linda Palaccio, and you are listening to A Taste of the Past here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today, I am very pleased to have two special guests with me. Anya von Bremsen. Anya is a very well-published writer, food writer, and journalist in general. She is a regular contributor for Travel and Leisure magazine, does a lot of travel and food writing, has published a couple of cookbooks, The Spanish Table and Please to Table. There's an Italian book there too, is there not? No? No, that's next to come.
Book, okay. Around the world.
Around the world, right. But Please to Table, the Russian dishes, that is certainly the tome that is one of my favorites because it really gives a whole view of Russian cuisine. And she is the newly published author of Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking. Now, this is not a cookbook. This is a memoir, an evocative memoir of food and life in growing up in Soviet Russia and then post-time having emigrated to the United States. And as a special treat, we've got Anya's mother here with us, Larissa. Welcome, Larissa.
Thank you.
From whom Anya learned many dishes, or has shared many dishes, and was an inspiration to her in writing food. Anya, I'm going to start with you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You've often said, especially in this book, your memoir, Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking, that you have somewhat been conflicted about becoming a food writer. What was the conflict in that for you?
Well, first of all, you know, I come from a society where there was barely any food. So I find this very ironic.
So a little background.
I grew up in the Soviet Union in the late 60s and early 70s, before we immigrated in 1974. And, you know, the subtitle of the book is A Memoir of Food and Longing. Mm-hmm. And longing is the kind of the central concept. It's a book about not having food as much as it is about having it. It's about shortages and what food meant, you know, to me, my family, and, you know, the entire Soviet nation, as they used to say. So it's very much about, you know, scarcity.
Right. And this idea of longing, food and longing, and I love, you quote in one of the articles that you wrote about the book, you quoted Herb Cain and the wonderful journalist, and he said, "Nostalgia is memory without the pain." Does this sort of describe a little bit about what you've been going through and with some of the dishes that you and your mother have been trying to recreate?
Well, actually, it's quite the opposite. I quote Herb Cain in an article that I just did for Travel and Leisure about the current wave of nostalgia for the Soviet Union in Russia right now, where, you know, they suddenly think, oh, it was such a cool time and we were all better people, and they completely airbrush all the historical trauma, you know, the millions of people that were killed by the regime, you know, the whole kind of dictatorial aspect. The term I use for in this book a lot is poisoned Madeleine.
I love that.
Yeah,
that
so you
metaphor
take the
that
Proust
you give, yes.
Idea of this idealized childhood, you know, triggered by, you know, a certain food, and I said, well, you know, our pasts were ideologized instead of idealized, and a lot of the food brings back, you know, very difficult memories.
For you, yes.
You know, so memories of the shortages, memories of, you know, longing, not having, memories of, you know, food, you know, gone bad. You know, it's this whole kind of rich brew, a rich layering of, you know, very conflicting feelings. And, you know, conflicting feelings that we felt for the state. Like my mom, for instance, she's very anti-Soviet and
right.
We fled that state.
And that's
so how do you love foods foods from a terrible state.
That's right.
I mean, that's
do you think that by and large, a lot of these people where there is this rush to bring back everything with the CCP, the Soviet symbols and all these old dishes, are they younger generations that don't remember this?
Well, yeah, there's a whole post-Soviet generation. You know, you hear it a lot. Even the kids, they say, "Oh, Granny, tell me about what was life like in the USSR." USSR has kind of is being, you know, really mythologized,
glamorized,
totally glamorized. You know, because it sells well. It's a brand. You know, it's become a brand. Mm-hmm. You know, that the politicians use it. You know, to kind of signify, you know, power, stability. We were once a great empire. You know, companies use it who produce various items. You know, it's a political and commercial brand.
All right. Well, Larissa, you were always kind of a dissident. Refusenik, I guess, were you? I don't. But you were always anti-establishment. How did you grow up? What were you cooking?
Yeah, but I didn't become right away when I was born, because I was born really very patriotic family and they loved everything. And I mentally loved everything myself. But emotionally, since very early childhood, I remember this feeling of that life was miserable, that it was lack of something important. And since I started reading very, very early in my life, I just found in the book something which I never even heard in real life, never saw. So after Stalin's death, exactly, I was 19 or 18, so then I opened my eyes. Oh, my eyes were opened, and I realized that everything went wrong from the very, very beginning. It was a tragedy, and it was everywhere. And especially remembering all this starvation and really lack of food and limited supply and nothing to we wanted to, and we couldn't get it. So everything made me, dissident. We were not refusnik. We were lucky because we were allowed to leave Russia
right. Exactly
very soon after we applied. So it was a very good thing.
That's good.
Being
raised of the Jewish in a Jewish family, too, that brought extra problems, I would imagine, in terms of how you were treated, what you were able to have access to.
Yeah, that's right. I would say that family wasn't really Jewish family, not observers, mm-hmm. but at the same time, our name, it's Frumkin, and we had this number 5 issue in our passport, which was Jewish, and that was, very... lots of obstacles brings to our
right. Existence. Right.
Number 5, just to clarify, number 5 was, you know, the graph in your passport that stated your nationality. And Jewishness was defined in ethno-national terms, not as a religious identity. So you could be a Russian, a Kazakh, an Uzbek, or a Jew. And in the 1970s, being a Jew was not a desirable category.
Right.
And, you know, in terms of foods, you know, for instance, we grew up completely secularized because, you know, Jewish religion was, you know, banned or semi-banned. So, you know, in the book I write about my first encounter with gefilte fish in Odessa, not, you know, we lived in Moscow, and it shocked me because I didn't know that Jewish food even existed. I remember, like, when I saw matzah, you know, hidden away by some old Jewish lady, you know, for Passover, I was also shocked. I was like, what is this, you know? Because eating something was an expression, if it was an expression of an undesirable identity, it could really land you in trouble.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you started, so when you were young even, and times were tough, there was no money, there was no food, even if you had, if you had money, but you weren't part of the elite, the government elite, so things weren't available to the common person. But your mother always made it special for you. And, you know, it's interesting. I started out talking about comfort food, foods we long for from our youth and our childhood. And you talked about a dish in particular, and I'm going to ask Larissa about it first, and then I'm going to ask your take on it. And Larissa, it was you didn't have a whole lot in the pantry, but you managed to make some fried eggs and brown bread. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes, sometimes we really didn't have any money for any special food, but had eggs and brown bread, which was always available, not very expensive. And so it was... Now it is remembered like a delicious things. I just, in the butter, I fried pieces of bread and then added scrambled eggs. And it became something very, very desirable and even like holiday food.
Right. Well, necessity is the mother of invention, they say. And for you, Anya, this dish evokes memories of your childhood, obviously. And
well, it was an interesting time for me and my mom because I grew up in a communal apartment, you know, where 18 families shared a kitchen.
Quite a wonderful description in the book,
I must say. It's hilarious. It was just something, you know, out of a dark comedy. You could make a movie about that. And my father abandoned us after I was born, but we continued to live with him and his mother in one room because of the housing shortage. And then finally, my mom and I got our own apartment, private apartment in the outskirts of Moscow. And, you know, we were extremely happy together. We were like this little newlyweds, you know. Finally, we had privacy, and my mom loved me, and I loved her. You know, but we lived on my father's alimony, which was, you know, below poverty. So my mom would, you know, I remember, you know, the smell. It was like dark Russian sourdough bread, mm-hmm. you know, very dense, you know, and she fried it into cubes. And, you know, this delicious little toasty kind of things. And then you know, the eggs would run all over it. But, you know, bread was something that was almost always available because the government remembered the trauma of the World War II, you know,
with the
bread rationing. And bread was something sacred. And also the year I was born, there was a grain failure in 1963. And Khrushchev, you know, tried to raise food prices, and his agricultural policies were a total fiasco. You know, he was completely... obsessed with corn, you know, mm-hmm. at the expense of grain, and you know the grain crisis and the bread shortages that arose from that cost him his leadership. He was, you know, pushed out of office, and after that, you know, the Brezhnev leadership that lasted for 18 years, essentially, you know, never changed the bread prices, and made sure that bread was always available because there were, you know, really hard political lessons that even in a totalitarian country. You know, bread riots are not a good thing. So bread was always cheap, always available. It's something you could always count on, and it was delicious.
Well, and also something that is, you know, in every culture, there is that, you know, the tears fall into certain foods that are prepared when, you know, during times of sadness. Love flows into certain foods, and it makes the cake rise or whatever. So obviously there was love flowing into this dish that your mother made because she had nothing and she was making something special to feed you. That has to play in big in the memories. I mean, it, you know, in
yes, and my mother also because you know, to make our life, you know, she's a dreamer. She still is, and you know, despite all the shortages, despite the grayness, you know, of our life, she always fantasized about food. You know, ever since she herself started cooking, so she would make all this, you know, very frugal dishes, like the omelet, or you know, some cabbage soup, and she would call them exotic names like potafe. Or, you know, she would make a Russian pie and call it pizza. And you know, she read, you know, like crazy. She read Proust. She read Hemingway. She read all these novels. And she would take the names of the dishes. She had no idea what they actually tasted like. But she would, you know, I remember she read to me the passage about the Madeleine from Proust. And we were like, what is this Madeleine?
What is it?
What can it taste like? We had absolutely no clue. But it filled us with longing just to imagine that we were, you know. So she would serve me some, you know, black bread toast and saying, oh, this is a Madeleine.
Well, it's interesting. Larissa, you had said before the show that you've always been interested in food history.
Yeah, that's right. And for me, food history started with Russian literature because they so vividly and so colorfully they just described, I mean, great Russian writers, Tolstoy, Gogol, and Goncharov, and Chekhov, of course. And so all those dishes were just Many of them were available because we could bake something, we could make something, and ingredients sometimes were very simple, like if you're making borscht or shish or whatever. Mm-hmm. But
she's a cabbage soup.
Cabbage soup, yeah. And I always try to make that. But especially interesting was what they ate in Zagranitsa.
Abroad.
Abroad.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah. Your fascination with Zagranitsa.
Yeah. And but there was one food for the poorest people, which we never mentioned before, but I remember it. It was raw onion cut into pieces, and it was some vinegar, and a brown bread, and the most important ingredient, this is sunflower oil. And all together with this brown bread, it was so delicious. I just recently made my salad, and I ate it kind of this. And it was so great.
And I mean, it does sound, and pickled onion. Pickled onions, it sounds like the onions are pickled in the vinegar. But pickled onions and a panzanella, or, you know, add a few tomatoes, and there you have another dish. It sounds like a delicious dish.
Yeah.
You made a lot of these dishes from your imagination, from memory. From reading the books. So you got a lot of your ideas from literature, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
But the book that was the book, the tome of the cookbook, was The Book of Tasty and Healthy Food. Anya, can you describe this from what you remember from your mother? Did you have this book in the home?
Well, The Book of Tasty and Healthy Food was like the sort of totalitarian kitchen Bible.
Was that 1939?
It was brought out
first
by the Soviet Food Commissariat in 1939. That was the first edition, and it really tried to create a fantasy of abundance and joy in a country, you know, that just went through unbelievable historic upheavals. You know, the first five-year plan, the collectivization, the enforced kind of industrialization. You know, millions of people dead from the famines. But Stalin decided, you know, that finally it was time to kind of push this ideal that they've, you know, socialists has achieved so much. And the cookbook is this incredible kind of piece of fantasy with, you know, lavish photos of, you know, non-existent products.
Unattainable, a fiction book, right?
At the same time, there were a lot of simple recipes that could be made, you know, and it went through 14 different editions. It survived, you know, until the end of the Soviet Union, until 1991. And it's still very popular today. And each new edition sort of reflected the shift in the regime.
Uh-huh.
For instance, you know, in the late 1930s, were quite internationalist. You know, the Soviet Union believed in the internationalist idea. So, you know, there's ketchup, there's cornflakes, there's Jewish dish, there's a dish from certain ethnic minorities.
A lot of quotes from Stalin.
Yes. But the ethnic minorities were later deported by Stalin, for instance, like the Kalmyks. There was this anti-Jewish hysteria after the World War II. So, for instance, the iconic 1952 edition is really xenophobic. It purges all this kind of, you know, foreign elements from the book. Then, you know, after Stalin dies, all the quotations from Stalin are deleted. Then with Khrushchev, you know, who kind of preached, you know, streamlined, functional approach to design, the cover becomes, you know, streamlined and functional. So it's very interesting as a political document as well as a cookbook.
All right. Well, Larissa, you brought up the term Zagranitsa. Zagranitsa, describe what that term actually means. You said something about it, Anya, but we'll have...
Yeah, of course, we lived in the Iron Curtain time, and so Zagranitsa, so foreign countries, it was something desirable. It was something we imagined very well through literature, through paintings, especially impressionists, and it was something we felt we knew, but it was not available for us to be there and to taste it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it was, I had dreams Repeated dreams, how I turned into a little bird or a little insect like a fly, and I am in Paris, and I am at the door of the cafe, and I smell it, and now I think I will find out what it is. Huh. But all the but time the
word,
I woke up.
The word itself, zagranica, granica is border. Zagranica means beyond the border. So it's a very loaded, you know, it's a very loaded word. It's a border that was close to us so that we could never cross.
Yeah. So you, the two of you took to creating or recreating, because you didn't make them at the time, but dishes that, as you say, were sort of bittersweet, dishes that pretty much were symbols of the regime, the elitist, but you longed for them in a way. What were some of these dishes in particular?
Well, the book is organized into decades of the Soviet century. You know, the chapters are, you know, 1910, 1920, 1930, and, you know, it's a mix of family history, of a family memoir, and social history, and as well as this cooking chronicle of me and my mom cooking our way through the 10 decades of the Soviet experience. And for each of the decades, we picked, you know, a dish that was emblematic both politically and for us personally. So the 1910, the 19-teens, we start with kulebiaka, which with this lavish, elaborate, layered Russian fish pie that was very tall, you know, went up, 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 and it's layered with blini. So you kind of have dough upon dough, you know, rice, mushrooms. And it's something that was being lavishly described in Gogol, Nikolai Gogol, and Chekhov. You know, it's this literary dish that was famous in turn of the century in Moscow. So with that dish, we say goodbye to Tsarist cuisine, to the, you know, the golden age of Russian food. And then in 1917 comes, the revolution happens, there's no more food, you know, everything just kind of collapses, and Russian cuisine, you know, is essentially, you know, declared, you know, bourgeois, and, you know, the Bolsheviks want to change everything. In the 1920s chapter, it's interesting, I talk about the Jewish identity and, you know, my parents who met in Odessa, which was a very Jewish city, where my mother's grandmother ran a sort of a semi-underground canteen mm-hmm. out of her house. And, you know, so it talks about Jewishness, and so the dish is gefilte fish. That gefilte fish that I encountered in Odessa when I was about 9 years old, and it kind of shocked me with the meaning of the Soviet Jewishness. And in the 30s talks about katlete, the meat patties that became at that time kind of the all-Soviet industrialized, mass manufactured product.
So meat patties, which we would almost, you know, translate as a cutlet, but it wasn't really even a cutlet. It was a meat
kind
patty.
Of more like
but
a hamburger.
Sounds like, but it sounds like a cutlet.
It was more like a hamburger, you know, like a meat cake. And then for 1940s, for instance, we were wondering which dish to prepare, because that chapter is very harrowing. It's about World War II mm-hmm. and, you know, the terrible starvation. And it's about my grandfather, my father's father, who was a top intelligence officer, who was a spy. And it's about my mother losing her rationing card when she was 7 years old. So it was a very, you know, very tragic, you know, chapter. So finally I decided, no, instead of a recipe, we're going to have an image of a ration card from the siege of Leningrad, 1941. In the siege, you know, a million people died from starvation. And one ration of bread, you know, 128 grams, you know, less than 4 ounces, could actually spell the difference between survival and death.
Absolutely.
So it goes on and on. There are nine recipes at the end of the book.
And, of course, we would be remiss not to mention the Salat Olivier.
The Salat Olivier, if you ask, what is the most iconic, emblematic Soviet dish, you know, it will have to be Salat Olivier. And it's a potato salad with pickles, drenched in mayonnaise. Sometimes you add chicken to it, sometimes crab, sometimes nothing. But it has a very fancy bourgeois past, because it was a hit in 1860s at a French restaurant in Moscow called L'Hermitage, mm-hmm. where it was prepared by Chef Lucien Olivier. Of course, the original dish featured grouse, crayfish, cornichons, you know, a special Provençal sauce. And then Grouse, you know, the poet of the revolution, Vladimir Mayakovsky, wrote a jingle, "Eat, gobble your pineapple, chomp on your grouse, your last day of is coming, your bourgeois louse." So actually grouse, pineapple, all this kind of tsarist delicacy become, you know, become like public enemies number one. And then the dish was kind of reinvented in the 1930s by a chef, you know, who supposedly worked at L'Hermitage, but it was Sovietized. So instead of crayfish, for the pink color, they put just boiled carrots. instead of grouse, they put, you know, some chicken meat or kielbasa. So, you know, it becomes this kind of all Soviet dish, really delicious, and all smothered, you know, in the newly produced, newly mass-produced industrial mayonnaise. And it's just like the best potato salad. The pickles, you know, give it that tang. And everyone has their own recipe. My mom makes hers with fresh cucumber in addition to the pickle. And a little bit of apple, which gives it kind of this lovely crunch.
So everyone has their own memory of their own version of salad.
But that's definitely, you know, not just comfort food, but it's also festive. Because mm-hmm. mayonnaise was a little hard to get, so, you know, you had to line up for it. So it's something that was eaten for New Year's. And then New Year's, in Russia, New Year replaced Christmas, because Christmas was a religious holiday and was banned. So New Year was when all the families got together around a festive table, waiting for the Kremlin clock to strike 12 and for Leonid Brezhnev to come on, you know, with his, you know, festive speech. And he was just this kind of decrepit idiot. And there you have this festive bowl of salat Olivier. It's a very cherished
fun.
Memory.
Yeah, fun, indeed. Larissa, a memory that maybe isn't quite as pleasant. Tell me about vobla.
A vobla, that's a very pleasant memory because it was something, because it was lack of many things, so we loved vobla.
First, what vobla is, yeah, what?
Vobla is a Caspian fish. I think it's called, in English, it's called roach fish. And it's dried in salt, you know, to this kind of completely petrified state. And this is, you know, this is something you ate with beer. Uh-huh. And you broke your teeth.
Kind of like, you know, a new meaning to fish chip. Not fish and chips, but fish and chip.
It was really hard. You had to whack it against the table. You know, there was a whole ritual. You kind of spread the newspaper on the table, and you whack the fish against the table to loosen the skin, and you kind of pulled off the skin. Then, you know, you kind of broke your gum, you know, broke your teeth, you know, trying to eat it. But it was, you know, every strip of this kind of.
But Larissa, you say it was a pleasant memory.
No, because we loved it, and we stayed in line for many hours to get vobla and this fish, and we got sacks of it, big bag, because it's very light. And so I remember that summertime in the dacha was nothing to eat at all. And this vobla and brown bread, it was our most important food.
So it was enough to sustain you during, yeah.
Yeah,
during
and, it, and actually it's very good with beer. Uh-huh. It's a great beer, zakuska.
Now it's really popular. You know, they have, you know, the Soviet-style beer halls. You know, the fanciest restaurateur in Moscow, Arkady Novikov, he has a place which is like the Soviet-style beer hall with, you know, Soviet-style beer, with that vobla fish. You know, everyone cries. Everyone loves it.
Drink a lot of beers jerked, and eat the fish and cry, right? Mm-hmm. Well, there are so many wonderful memories and some painful memories, of course. It's nostalgia. It's a memoir. But it is a beautiful book, and it really is, it because you take food through the decades that you recreate, it really is a history of what was going on at the time. And I think anyone who was, you know, hoping to get recipes from that, they will not be disappointed, because even though there are not recipes per se, the descriptions of the dishes, the descriptions of your travels, and life at the time.
Actually, there are recipes.
Well, yes, there are. At the end, right. I'm sorry.
It's not a cookbook.
Right, but not a cookbook.
There are recipes.
Per se. Yeah. And I thank you for writing it, because it was an eye-opener for me. And it was a wonderful book. And Larissa, I'm so glad that you were here to share your thoughts as well.
Thank you.
Obviously, a wonderful influence on your daughter. And thank you so much.
Right.
And thank you for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.